I think that one thing that stayed out in my mind, and that is that other religions, the emphasis is on a certain emotional relationship between people and God. In Judaism, it's true that there is such a thing, but the nevertheless, the most important thing in Judaism is knowledge. And therefore, I would say that Judaism is unique, and that is the religion. It is the religion of the mind, in the sense that Yahadus, Judaism, recognizes that a person serves and worships God with his mind when he thinks. And we know that in the morning, we say one of the things we say in the morning is a chapter from Mishnayos, which states Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, that the greatest mitzvah that we have is the knowledge of Torah. So that our religion is one of knowledge. It is the most important activity, the most divine activity that a person can do, according to our faith. As a matter of fact, there are two types of places of worship. One is a synagogue, that's called a shul, as we commonly refer to it. The other one is a Beis HaMidrash, which is a place where we learn, where we study. And the Talmud says, which of the two is holier? Which of the two has more holiness? The Talmud decides that the Beis HaMedrash, the place where we study, is even holier than the place where we pray, which certainly we know is a holy place, the sanctuary. So that Yahadus, Judaism, has a different slant on knowledge. Other religions, on the contrary, have tried to suppress knowledge throughout the ages because they felt that knowledge will interfere with their beliefs in their religion. But our system of religion, Judaism, maintains just the opposite, that the most important thing that we can do is to study and gain knowledge. And there is no such thing as a conflict between knowledge and religion, because on the contrary, knowledge is our religion. And therefore I say that to see people get together today in this fashion, just to come and study knowledge of Torah, I think that this is certainly the highest form of activity that a person, a human being, can do. And therefore I say I'm very honored to be here with you today. I would just like to again reiterate what Mr. Kaplan said, that this is not really a lecture. It's not a sermon, but it's a class. And in the yeshiva, I don't give any lectures or sermons, but we have many classes. And the classes is always give and take. And we're always happy to take the questions of the participants, and not just simply to sit back and listen to one rabbi or one Rosh Hashiva speak. So that's why I want you to feel free to ask any question. As was mentioned, is the Torah, the concept of Torah Misinai, of God giving the revelation at Sinai. Now, as I mentioned to you before, since Judaism maintains that the essence of life is knowledge, our religion is different in that we maintain that there is a knowledge of the fact that God gave the Ten Commandments at Sinai. It is not simply a belief, but it's based upon some type of knowledge. If you'll take a look now at your Chumash, I think you have them. It's in on page 758. That's Deuteronomy 4:9. Okay. All right. Now, one of the reasons that we take different areas, different subjects, and primarily in Judaism, as in all sciences, all areas of knowledge, there's usually complexity and profundity. And what we try to do is to take an area where you can appreciate the profundity without having to go through many complexities, because complexities are really for a person that has a lot of time and can master the complexities of the area. However, in this case, I'll have to beg your indulgence, because the reason why we chose this topic was not because of the nature of the ideas themselves. There are many beautiful ideas in the Torah that I could have expounded on, that we could have discussed today, that would be perhaps more interesting in a direct sense. But this area, the reason why it was chosen, is because of its extreme importance, since it functions as a basis of the entire Torah. So that this area is chosen for a separate reason. A different reason altogether. The reason is because the nature of the subject is so pertinent, so important, everything is based on it. So therefore, we might have to go through a bit of logical formulation And it might be a bit tedious, but I'll try to make it as clear and as lucid as I can. And with your help, maybe I can make it even more clear if there's anything that you don't understand. But it will be a subject which has some complexity to it. So it requires that you follow along step by step, and we'll try to take it slowly. If you take a look at the 4.9 of Deuteronomy, it says like this. Look at the English side. If you have the Chumash, it's right on top. You see where it says 9. So this is a quote from Moses. When he spoke to the Jews, at the end, he summed up, in the last of Deuteronomy, he summed up the essence of the Torah, what the Torah is about, the main ideas of the Torah. And he repeats, Ma'amid Har Sinai, the event that took place at Sinai, God's revelation to the Jews at Sinai. And he addresses them as follows. He says, only take heed to thyself, and keep thy soul diligently, lest thou forget the things which thine eyes saw, and lest they depart from thy heart all the days of thy life, but make them known unto thy children and thy children's children. He's referring to, as he explains in the next sentence, the day that thou stoodest before the Lord thy God in Horeb, when the Lord said unto me, assemble me the people, and I will make them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they live upon the earth, and that they may teach their children. So we see one thing from this passage. We see, namely, that the concept, the reason why, it's very difficult for us to say why God does something, or why God did something or other, what God's intention was, or what his purpose was. Because as human beings, being created by him, our knowledge is so limited that we can't fathom his knowledge. But sometimes we can understand why he said something. And that is when the Torah, when he explains it himself through his book, through the Torah. And here, Moses explains to us, he says that God's purpose in his revelation at Sinai was for the generation that lived, that saw this revelation, but not only for them, but for their children as well. You see the way he says at the end of passage 9, but make them known unto thy children and thy children's children. And again, at the end of passage 10, he says that they may learn to fear me all the days that they live upon the earth, and that they may teach their children. So that when God made the revelation at Sinai, he wasn't going to make a revelation every generation. That's clear. But his wisdom dictated that a revelation should take place at a certain time in history, and that this event should stand from that time on forever, and it will not be necessary to repeat it. Okay. Again, if we take a look at Yisro, that is in Exodus, page 292. Moses, lo, I come unto thee in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with thee, and may also believe thee forever. So the purpose was, forever didn't mean for the life of Moses or for the life of those people, but forever meant throughout eternity as long as the world existed. God here was saying that this event which took place at Sinai would have repercussions not just in that generation, but that this event will always remain as a testimony forever, as long as the world exists. Now, again, it's the exact same thing which is stated a little more clearly, perhaps, in Deuteronomy. I just wanted to bring both sources. The difference between the two sources is the source that I brought second, which is actually the first source, is when it actually took place. The second source is when Moses was repeating, before he died, he repeated to the Jews all the main important essence of the Torah, and he repeated it, he was more verbal than the actual event, because he wanted to clarify to them, make sure they understood every point. So that at both times, however, it's quite clear that the revelation at Sinai was done one time and for all. Now, of course, the question that confronts us is, how could God, granted his divine wisdom, but how could he possibly do something, perform an event that would happen one time, and that we sitting here today should be able to have knowledge of that event as if it took place? And this would seem quite difficult. One would say, well, if God wants us to believe in him, and if he saw fit to make a revelation for that generation, why doesn't he see fit to make a revelation again? And people often ask, they say, well, I don't see any miracles today. I don't see any miracles today, so then maybe God is on vacation. Maybe he's not really doing his job. But we see in the Torah that God really forewarned this. And this is quite clear from the biblical account, both accounts of the revelation, that the revelation was not going to be reproduced for succeeding generations, but it was going to be once and for all. The question therefore naturally arises, how did God, what was his plan? What did he have in mind? How could I know today what happened then? So that is the basic question. Okay? Anybody have any question on this point? Then, in order to proceed with this important question, I would say that what we should do is, we should approach the problem in terms of what area the problem really is found in first. Let's go to the general. But before we do that, let's just premise. There's one premise that I must lay down before we start. And that is that everything that we say today is based upon one premise. The premise of consistency. I don't think anybody doubts the premise, but I just want to mention it. In other words, that we can't act logically one way at one time and another way at another time. We can do it, and we often do it, but we realize when we do that, that it's a shortcoming on our part, not that this is really the rational way to be. So that whatever we're going to say now is what we're going to say in terms of the proof, well, my students call it the proof of Thermosina. I hate to refer to it as the proof of Thermosina, because whenever you say proof, the question is proven to the satisfaction of who? I mean, it might be proven to you, not to somebody else. I would rather call it the basis that God used, the basis of Thermosina, that God used in presenting us Thermosina, or the demonstration of Thermosina. So I'd rather use an objective term rather than a subjective term. So we'll begin with the principle of consistency. That's the only principle, the only axiom that I am laying down. And then we'll proceed with the arguments. Now, the question is, if we want to know about Sinai, so let's put it in a general way. What area does Sinai refer to? What area? I mean, what topic? What subject matter? Is it biology? Is it psychology, science? I mean, what exactly is the area that Sinai refers to? If we're interested in Sinai, we want to investigate Sinai, well, let's understand what is Sinai? What area of knowledge is it from?
Geography.
So there was a mountain was using where it took place.
Yeah.
Correct, right? Definitely geography. Geography. There is certainly another subject we'll have to introduce if we want to really speak about Sinai. Geography was a factor, no question about it. But before we get to the geography, how do we know about the geography? See?
Is this a meeting place or a
day? Yes, I'm sorry. It's chosen. But right now, that's a detail on why a particular point was chosen. Let's first understand what happened over there. The area I think that we would recognize immediately is history. Isn't that true? Because if we are discussing an event that took place several thousand years ago, then we're getting involved and we're trying to investigate and see what God's divine plan was to make it known to us today, then we are getting involved in history because this is a historic event. And if it is an historic event, then we have to understand what is our knowledge of history in general. Once we have our knowledge of history in general, then we'll be able to see how Sinai fits in to this big framework of history. But before we understand how we have a knowledge of history, we will not understand how we have a knowledge of Sinai, you see. Just like you can't understand the particular in biology unless you understand the basic concepts. You can't understand the particular in mathematical equations if you don't understand what a number is. Right? So let's take the more general. The more general is history. Now the question often arises about what we want to do is, in other words, have a knowledge of Sinai, which means, ipso facto, that we must have a knowledge of history, as Sinai is a part of history, or a study, an object of study of history. Okay? Now the question raises itself, and I'm sure it has raised itself to you many times. Maybe you've glossed over it. Many times we think of questions and then we sort of forget about them, you know, keep on going because they might bother us too much and make life a little difficult. So we say, well, don't worry about that. But let's try to retrieve some of those questions that annoy us and annoy us sometimes. I think that one question that I'm sure everybody's experienced is, whenever you read something in a history book, you might think to yourself, how do I know this? Did it really happen? I have to believe the author? Maybe it didn't happen. Why are we so sure about this? And as such, I mean, certain doubts are raised in our minds. We've seen cases where historians might disagree as to what actually took place. And then we're really confused, because one authority tells us one way, another one tells us the other way. They each present their reasons, and maybe we'll side with one over the other. But we immediately feel, just a moment, that this isn't really an exact science. I mean, whatever you're going to say, you might have a nice reason for why the king beheaded his wife. But who knows, maybe he just had a stomach ache. I mean, it's possible. Anything is possible. And we start questioning, really, how we know these things, and what basis there is for this knowledge. And we don't go so far usually as to question history entirely. We usually stop before that. We say, well, this point which the scholars disagree on, we don't know what it is. Maybe he's not, maybe he's not. We're not going to start questioning whether there was a Rome, or whether there was a Greece, or whether there was an Alexander the Great, or an Aristotle, or a Plato. We wouldn't go that far, but certain details we would question. Now I would like to bring the question down more basically. How do we know the basic facts of history? Never mind what the historian disagree on. But let's say, for instance, we know that, we assume that we know that George Washington was the President of the United States. So how do we know this fact, first President of the United States? How do we know this?
It's
written, right.
Library sources.
Right.
Observers.
Do you have observers?
There's inference, and there's value judgment.
Okay.
Ethnography and people that do historically.
Good, right. But there is no question about it that there are observers. I would question the are, though, the present form. I would say there were observers, right? Now the question is, how do we know that there were observers? Because we really don't have any direct evidence, you see. And even if we should say, well, we have his coat, we have his helmet, or we have his guns, or his medals, I mean, whatever he might have, how do we know that they're his, see? Now this might sound like an absurd question, but I think that it's something that must be answered. Before we go into this question, I would venture to say that it is not only history that we're dealing with, but we're really dealing with every area. In other words, if you read in the book that a certain, let's say you're a student of biology, you read about certain experiments that took place, and you read about certain genetic experiments, you read about Mendel's laws and Mendel's experiments, how do you know that they took place? The book might be fabrication. Right? You'll say, well, that's absurd.
Excuse me? In sciences, there's
replication. Right. But, certainly, every scientific experiment is not replicated. If I'm a student of physics, and I'm studying about nuclear explosions, you wouldn't expect me to make a nuclear explosion before I start studying the topic. That might be devastating to the entire world. So that, while certain experiments might be replicated, nevertheless, if a student went ahead and was going to perform every experiment as he studied that was ever performed from year one, you realize that he didn't graduate in the college, I don't think in 4 years. It might take him maybe 80 years or 100 years. And many experiments he might not be able to perform. They're too costly to have every experiment performed for every student. But yet we have people graduating from college, medical students who study and who graduate from college, and they haven't performed every single experiment. I don't believe that anyone who is a student in any scientific field would maintain that he has seen every single experiment duplicated.
One experiment, yes. One forms a model. These are the steps in the scientific process. The model is based on many experiments.
Right. Now the question...
The hypotheses come from the experiment. The model's formed.
Good.
Now that model explains things that come after.
Good,
there
very good.
There are deductions that are taken from...
Good. Good, I agree with that. I agree with it. Yeah.
The problem is with the proof. You can never really prove anything scientific, absolutely.
No, you don't want to.
But
the scientist works with hypotheses. Everything, you never prove a hypothesis. You accept it, you reject it. And the next person who comes along has to give it. Accept, yes, that's true.
Accepting like
that. But that doesn't mean truth, that it's truth or absolute. It's acceptance until we find some other data that makes us reject it.
Okay, good, fine. Well, I'm not questioning that. You see, I'm not questioning the scientific process. I'm not questioning that you have to accept the best possible explanation that we have at the time. No question about that. Then when we see new experiments, then we might have to revise or change our concepts. I agree with that 100%. But I'm saying, my question is, as a student myself, if I'm a student of science, how do I know that those experiments took place? What proof do I have that these things took place?
You just have to believe it.
I have to believe it. Okay? I have to believe it. Because how do I know?
I don't believe it's documented somewhere.
All right, documented. But even documentation is quite difficult to prove. Because we know there can be non-authentic documentation. In other words, if I go into a school and I'm going to really track down everything that I know, I want to know everything myself, do you realize that before I would get started, it would take me 20 or 30 years till I went through all the documentation to prove that everything was correct? And even if I did do that, I might be fooled at certain points. I'm bringing this in not to sound absurd. I'm not suggesting at this point that we leave and we reject everything that we ever saw and never study anything because we do not know anything. See, I'm not trying to suggest that. I'm bringing it to absurdity because I want to show you, I want to bring it back and show you what the premises are. And that, on the contrary, there are good reasons to accept certain things at certain times. But what I want to find out is what those reasons are, you see. Now, let's start again. Let me give you an illustration, and perhaps we'll be able to understand how our minds work and what we do accept. The point of acceptance was mentioned very well. What we do accept, but we don't accept everything. Certain things we reject. But certain things we get, certain things we accept. Now, why is it that some things we're liable to accept, other things we're liable to question, and other things we're liable to reject completely? You see? So that we find ourselves oftentimes in three categories. Whenever we read or study, we pick up a newspaper. We read something. We might accept it, question it, or reject it. Now, I say that when we do these things, there are certain rules that our minds are operating by. We don't just do it without any reason at all, arbitrarily. Just on the basis of how we feel at the time. But if we are intelligent people, then we should have some intelligent reason for either accepting, rejecting, or questioning. Now, what I would like to get down to is what are the principles which guide us, you see, during these moments and determine whether we should accept something, reject it, or question it. That's what I'd like to know. For instance, let me give you an illustration. I'll go back to the illustration of George Washington. If we were reading in a history book, in a textbook, that George Washington was the first president of the United States, we would hardly question this. But if we continued to read about the life of George Washington, we saw that one author maintained that he wore a size 10 boot. I don't think that we would be quite as certain about that fact as we would about the fact that he existed. Would you agree with me on that? Okay. You're about right. Okay. So, the good example, good illustration. Now, the question is, why? I would just like to ask you, why is that so? Why is it when you read about the fact that he was the first president, I don't think that a normal person in his right mind would question this. You see? He would accept it. Even though he didn't have any first-hand proof because he wasn't there. But nevertheless, he would accept it. Let us call it, and before we get maybe in order to clarify, to make things a little easier, let us give two different names to two different types of knowledge. I would say that anything which I see myself with my senses, I see that you people are here, you see me, this would be considered primary knowledge, first-hand knowledge. We see it ourselves. But the other type of knowledge that we have is secondary. Let's call it secondary knowledge. It's based on somebody else's observation. We didn't see it ourselves, but it's based on somebody else's observation. So that we are involved in our lifetimes with two types of knowledge. I don't think there's any other type. Just primary and secondary. And all of our lives are based upon that. And I would dare say that without secondary knowledge, we would hardly have any knowledge at all, because we would have to perceive ourselves with our own senses from scratch. Science would never advance, because you'd have to do everything all over again from the beginning. So without secondary knowledge, we would really be at a tremendous loss. We couldn't even go to a doctor without secondary knowledge, because if somebody tells you, look, I'm sorry to say you need a very serious operation, and we're importing one of the greatest doctors in the world from England. Well, if you're going to start going around and questioning, who knows, he's a doctor. How do you know he's from England? How do you know who he is? Then I'm afraid there wouldn't be enough time for the patient to make it. So that we have to, in our lives, even make decisions about our own life and death based upon secondary knowledge. And there isn't a chance, there isn't enough time, and I might not even be able to ever really find out through first-hand knowledge whether this man is a doctor or whether he's an imposter. The possibility is there. So that we have to put our lives... We have to put our lives in our hands when we make these decisions, and we have no choice. Secondary knowledge is not to be frowned upon. It's very important in our lives. The only question we have to understand is, which I think is advisable to understand, is on what basis are we operating here? And even though we seem to get along quite well without thinking about it, well, things seem to work out pretty well, but I think that if we have an understanding of it, a more accurate understanding of it, things might even work out better. We might even understand a little more. We might be more critical and might make better decisions. Okay, I see there's some questions at this point, so let me interrupt now and pick questions. Yes, I think you were first.
Yeah, as far as abilities of knowledge, we can further break down knowledge into cerebral cortex. The right side is more intuitive, and the left side is more, let's say, mathematical and logical. So that's just, I was just bringing that up to further break down what you mean by primary knowledge and secondary knowledge.
Right.
Primary knowledge can be both intuitive and what you would say firsthand.
Okay.
No, and same with secondary knowledge. And it is the nature of man to deal with even fact in that way.
Right.
And also, you know, throw in each generation or each time period, paradigms, certain paradigms. And that strong
science is empiricism. Yeah. It's based on perception and on knowledge and things like that.
Correct. Right, the deductions.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree with that.
The point.
What you said right now is not really the part of the brain that we use in these analyses. I think you'll agree that both parts of the brain will be used in any area that we approach. We could use both points in regard to secondary knowledge. And we start questioning and using deductions and figuring out whether it's so. Or we could use our intuition also in regard to secondary knowledge. Intuition is certainly used when I trust somebody. I mean, there's a certain amount of intuition there. If I intuit, can I trust this man? I have to draw universal from all the actions that he does and decide whether or not his actions are in line with deserving my trust. So that while you are correct, I agree with you 100% that knowledge should be broken down in many ways. But I'm only going to discuss the breakdown vis-a-vis primary and secondary knowledge. You see? Yes?
Yes. I'm wondering, are you saying then that Moses' was an experiential...
Moses?
Moses'
right.
Revelation at Mount Sinai was experiential
correct.
Knowledge.
Right.
Is that what you're
first-hand,
saying?
First-hand, right.
First-hand
yes.
Knowledge. And then it was transmitted orally.
Right.
To the others, but there had to be a basic faith to begin with.
Well, let me put it this way. At this point, I'm not even... I realize and I appreciate you going back to Moses, because that's the purpose. But I would say that at this point, let's forget about Moses at this point. Let's forget about Revelation. Let's take up another topic, and if we are successful in this other topic, then we'll go back to Moses and see if we can apply what we learned over here to there. You see? And see if we can understand it. But I agree that ultimately something like that will occur. Yes?
Now, this might be a jump too far, but...
Go ahead.
But I know that, for instance, when we're dealing with secondary knowledge, my credulity is strained most in certain areas and strained less, at least, in other areas. For
right.
instance, for some reason, which I can't really understand exactly why, I place more reliance on documentary evidence of some sort. Even though I might go further in the documentary
right.
evidence and ask...
Why?
Once more, for some reason, if it is written,
yeah, it's written.
I seem to give it further credence
right.
than if it's been spoken to me.
That's
in
true.
Other words, if somebody told me that that George Washington had a size 10 shoe,
right.
I would say, well, how do you know that? And he said, well, I read a diary that he wrote saying that he bought a pair of size 10 shoes.
Right.
And this diary is in the Library of Congress, and it's
right.
Documented. It's documented right. proof that he has a
size 10
shoes. Of course, we also can then say that he had a fantasy that he had larger shoe, or there's a difference between the size of his shoe and the size of his feet. You might
right.
like, we might make the inference that the size of his shoe is his feet is thin, but he liked gigantic shoes. Something like that. So I'm just saying, I get further reliance to that.
I get further reliance on something that's documented.
Yeah, so
why?
Help
tell us why. Yes, that helps us a lot. I agree with you. But could you explain it to us and tell us why this is so? I agree with the phenomenon. By the way, you know, Maimonides mentions in the Moran of Hucham, mentions an interesting thing. He's speaking in reference to the names of God. And he says that many people are of the opinion that if you recite certain names of God, you could do very wondrous and incredible things. Many of the laity believe that if you know the magical names of God, you'd be able to fly through the heavens or perform certain fantastic miracles. He says the reason for this is because, he says, that people who are foolish believed in such ideas and they wrote them down. And since the following generations found them in writing, they said, one second, this is written down. This must be authentic. It says, and therefore, many people were misled. So that many times, our belief, because of some, our feeling of belief and truth, in regard to something that's written down, can cause us to wander astray. We have to be very careful that not to allow certain things to affect us. But it's interesting. I would say, let's speak about the documented part. Why would you accept something that's documented more readily, or be feeling more secure in your knowledge in that area?
For instance, this lady had pointed out that in many fields where there's an historical event, there are several observers.
Yes.
And if you can glean, especially if you can somehow intuit or discover that they were not in collusion with each other, and they had given more than one particular statement to back this particular historical event, that seems to give me further feeling of comfortableness with this historical event.
Okay. All right. Very, very good point. Yes.
I think you hit on a key word there when you said comfortableness.
Yes. As a matter of fact, now that you mentioned it, I was going to bring it up myself. But now that you mentioned it, I would like to emphasize it, because I would like to say that many times events that occur that we don't feel comfortable about, we tend to reject. You see, now scientifically speaking, this is really not a very sound way of going about things, because there are unfortunately many things in reality which we don't like, but nevertheless they are. So that if we go about only accepting those parts of reality that we like, we're liable to find ourselves in trouble when we're confronted with a reality. Ultimately, it keeps on piling up. And then, boom, we're confronted with a reality and you can't deny it anymore. And if you had seen it all along, you might have been able to avoid it. We often know how people run into trouble that way. Because they see something which is going wrong, and instead of looking at it, facing the problem at the right time and taking care of it, they allow it to grow. How many times people have to go see a doctor, and they won't go to see the doctor because they're afraid what might be wrong? And then if, God forbid, if it's too late when they find out, then it's unfortunate. So that it is a bad thing, really, to operate that way. And it's true, people do operate that way. And I'll tell you something else. That the very subject that we are discussing today, which is the subject of Torah from Sinai, you have to realize, is a very charged topic. Because it involves our lives. And if we should say that we can demonstrate Torah from Sinai, then we might perhaps feel that we might not be so happy to hear that. Might be a bit difficult. I might say, well, if that's the case, then I better get started doing certain things. So that even in this area itself, we might have prejudices one way or another. I'll tell you an interesting thing. You know, I've given this demonstration several times, and I found even deeply religious people would not be willing to accept it. I found it difficult to accept. Why? Because even a person who's religious, figure, well, why, he should want to accept it, because he's giving away his whole life following his laws, and now we're showing him he's right, he should be very happy, right? That's not true. Because many times, people who are deeply religious, in the hidden corners of their mind, enjoy the fact that they don't really know for sure whether it's true. Because if they do something that's wrong, they feel they can always escape in that comfortable corner. You know? And say, well, maybe it's all nothing. But if you remove this from them, then they find that they're constantly face to face with this reality. It's a difficult thing to face. So that this point you mentioned is a very important one, and it comes up right today, right here today. It's valid.
Well,
yes?
Can't you just, how would you answer somebody that says you can't just have primary and secondary, you have to have faith, but all those have to faith.
Okay.
You can't reason out the existence of God, you have to start with the premise God exists.
All right.
Because the man would answer, even when he went to Moses, the man would answer, fine, I believe primary, that everything comes down, the Ten Commandments were handed down.
Right.
This was a beautiful exposition, morality of a brilliant man, who in order to sell the idea to the people of Israel, said it came from God.
Right.
A brilliant mind, he could work out, it's exactly right, you honor your father and mother, you shouldn't kill.
Right.
This is a human reasonable concept.
Right.
This is, if a brilliant individual, why do you have to have God said it?
Right.
The only way you have to have God said it is because the people won't believe it otherwise. But they say, if I tell him I said it, so therefore I'm going to figure out Moses and the smart fellow, I think I've God told me, I'm going to tell the people.
Right.
So you have to start from thinking.
Right.
How would you answer the individual who said, I'll take the Ten Commandments?
I would answer.
It's Moses' commandment.
Right. I would answer as follows. I would say that if Moses had done that, and if that was the essence of our Bible, and I realize that there are people that really maintain that this is the case, and maintain that there isn't, that we're wasting our time here this afternoon trying to demonstrate Torah from Sinai. But they maintain that...
From
Sinai. No, I mean from Sinai and from God. So, from Sinai, I mean from God, I don't mean from Moses. But I would say as follows, that if somebody would tell me that the Bible is a very wonderful book, has a lot of fine ethics in it, I would say that, would you not maintain that one of the fine ethics that are preached in the Bible is to be truthful? Would you maintain that that's a very fine and very valid ethic? And that anyone who is not truthful with you and who deceives you and leads you to believe that something is true when it isn't true is certainly not worthy of our respect. Therefore, I would say that if Moses was such an individual, and he begins every paragraph by Yadaber Ad Hashem El Moshe Lemar, and God spoke to Moses saying, etc., etc., etc. Next paragraph, and God spoke to Moses saying, etc., 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 so on throughout the entire Torah. I would say that if a man such as Moses was a truthful person, then how could he possibly write a book that's filled with lies and expect me to praise him as a truthful individual? On the contrary, I would take such a book and I would simply throw it in the garbage. I have nothing to do with it. Because I would say that a man like that is a deceitful individual. If he wants to teach me a philosophy, fine. Let him teach me his ideas. And let him tell me why they're beneficial. And let him help me in my life. That's a wonderful thing. But to lie is not the way to do it. You do not achieve any just means by being unjust. You do not create any good by being untruthful. I do not believe if a rabbi would go to one of his congregants and he wants to help him out, he'd tell him, God appeared to me last night and told me it's such and such, and that's why you should do this and that. I would say such a man is a charlatan. I would say he's a faker and a phony. I would say if you want to teach, then teach honestly, but do not teach with fraud. And therefore, if that was the case, I would have nothing to do with Moses and his book. I would say the man was a fraudulent individual.
Could he not been a fraud or dishonest? Could he have illusions or not? There are tons up into this. We're not really dishonest. Not fraud.
Well, that's another possibility.
This is really, he convinced himself.
Well, in that case, he was suffering from a form of insanity. In which case, I would very well question how valid his true ideas are, because if a person wants to believe that he is an emissary of God when in fact he's not, then we know if we study psychology that there are many forms of insanity which follow similar lines. There are many forms like that. That's what they've seen. So in that case, I would say Moses belongs to a distinct group which I wouldn't really be interested in dealing with.
Which groups?
Between
the group that you're interested in, or you think it's verifiable according to the contract,
right.
And it goes in half. But then the last year or so, last stuff in like some statue, somebody's house that was ruined, and it's supposed to be a miracle of some guy in the right. Now, I don't particularly believe that.
Right.
But how do you, for yourself, someone who logically wants to evaluate experience,
That question is a very pertinent question. That question is really part of what we have to answer right now. Right now is before the answer. After the answer, you have to present the question again. In other words, we didn't really give any solution yet. We've just been discussing it. We've stopped at this point. In other words, we're stuck right now at one point. The question is how do we decide between different things, whether to accept them, whether not to accept them? On what basis do we question, reject, or accept, right? And that's really the question that you're raising. You're giving me a particular incident and asking how I would deal with it. I can't deal with the particular until I tell you what the general formula is, right?
No, but okay. What beyond that, I'm also saying, I mean, what is it that makes us Jews, that makes us believe certain things?
That's the question.
As opposed to other traditions.
Okay, correct. That's exactly the question I'm missing right now. Exactly. And I think that question is of the utmost importance. And there, faith wouldn't help you. Because if you tell me faith, so I'll say, well, you can have faith over there too, right? That's the question. That's why I say that we have to have something more than just, and I maintain that Judaism is something more than just faith without any reason, without any reasoning at all. I say that in the Torah there is reasoning and there's a basis to believe, a rational basis to believe, Torah, the event of Sinai took place. And that's what I'd like to get to today. Yes?
Just a final question. Sure. Instead of being spoken to where God said the words,
right.
Man being intelligent and a rational individual, the word inspiration. Suppose this were so-called the word, whatever it means, divinely inspired.
Right.
He still would not be dishonest, lying.
Oh, but
not the concept And he got the, as a human individual, was able, just like Einstein could reason out the theory of relativity. He was called divine inspiration.
Right.
How do you get a concept, you
that's
get
right.
an idea.
I understand
it. It's something gets into your head and you realize that it's proper. And
I
not being a fraud, not a liar. Gee, this is a good idea. Here's 10 ideas.
That's right.
And they won't believe me otherwise. And yet, it must be divinely inspired. And what is wrong to my saying that God said it? Because it's the same thing, but divine inspiration.
You see, that would be very proper, divine inspiration. But if you were honest and you told me that's what it was, that's one thing. But when you say, and the Torah says, Vayishma et hakol midaber elav, you heard the sound that was produced from a specific area within the tabernacle. The Torah says specifically that Moses heard a specific sound which was produced. And the Ten Commandments can be more open when it says that the sound of the Moshe Hashem will have the Ten Commandments were verbal only from Mount Sinai.
The Rashi, could be a triple where the sound could cover, you could interpret.
You can interpret anything.
Yes.
But the point is, what we have to understand, an interpretation of an idea, an interpretation of a statement can never take the statement and make the statement mean something else. An interpretation has to fit into the literal meaning of the sentence. In other words, you can't just take the Torah and say, this is a book of physics. I'll interpret it as physics. I'll say that Bereshis is number one, and Shemos is two, and we'll start with mathematics, and we'll make it into a different book. I mean, this you realize is impossible. Every statement that a person says, if he is truthful, in other words, if I told you that if you invest right now $10,000 in such and such a stock, you will become a millionaire tomorrow, right? And then you did such and such, and unfortunately the stock went broke. I say, well, you didn't interpret what I said. I don't think you would be too happy to hear my answer. In other words, you can get an interpretation to be a deeper meaning, but deeper but not contradictory to the original meaning. But deeper but not contradictory to the original meaning. If I tell you something, it has to really mean that thing, and if it doesn't, then I'm a liar. You wouldn't accept the man who went up in court and gave all types of allegations, and then after you get finished, he'd say, well, you didn't interpret what I said. Say, interpret. Interpret means that what you're saying is true, plus, but not that what you're saying is a lie.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, there's one point about that. You're talking about that today, what you say.
Right.
And even in the Torah itself, the one interpretation where they said about it, he was a righteous man in his generation,
right.
Or a daughter. So we're talking about what something happened there. We're talking
correct.
About 4,000 years
right.
or more ago.
I agree.
That we're talking in context that we don't necessarily understand. Perhaps things were not.
Well,
perhaps they were different. They were talking out of our own minds as to how things went at that time.
I know.
Perhaps it was an entirely different situation.
Okay.
And therefore, we're judging by what we are today.
Right. I understand. My answer to you would be then this. That if it was totally different then, and if what we read today, we don't know how it was then, and I would say again, take the chumash and put it in the garbage. Because you can't understand it anyways. You don't know what happened then or what framework it's in. So it has no value to you. You have no use for it. Then I would say, there's a third possibility. It might be true, might be wonderful. Maybe Moshe wasn't a liar, and maybe he was divinely inspired even though he wrote something else, but what he wrote, we don't understand what he means. So what good is the whole book? The book doesn't mean anything. Whenever I read, it says, respect your neighbor, love your neighbor as yourself, or it says, respect your father and your mother. I'll say, maybe it's the death framework. What it meant was, don't take a pie and throw it in your father's face. But it didn't mean to have respect for him, because it meant a thousand things. So therefore, I would say, if that is the case, then the Bible becomes totally useless. Unless we could say that we understand what it means, and not that it's written in a framework in which we don't understand, we have no use for the Bible. So in either event, I say that either one of the three possibilities, the first possibility you mentioned was that Moshe telling us a lie, in which case I say that I would have no respect for the man. Otherwise, if he imagined things, then I say that he was insane, and I would certainly wouldn't want to do him. Third possibility is that he was neither, but that we don't understand his framework, then again I say we have no benefit from what he wrote. You see? So that either way, the Bible becomes meaningless. Either one of the possibilities that you present, we will wind up without a Bible. Yes?
However, you have to start from something. The
yes.
Bible isn't meaningless in that respect, because in this week's Time magazine,
yep.
totally unrelated, but bringing into the whole concept in the archaeological expedition, the Leakey...
I know, that's in Africa.
A piece of bone and construct
right.
a whole...
human head and our whole concept of when man, it's an amazing thing to read.
Absolutely.
You start with something, this is all interpretation. If you just look at it as it is, or as it looked in that day, you couldn't begin to do anything. So therefore, why are we wrong in interpreting something that, in the light of what it was then, trying to see how it looks today?
One second. I say, interpretation is fine. But again, I say interpretation cannot go against the literal meaning of anyone's words. The person tells you something, and it is proven that what he said is false. You can't explain it away by interpretation. If what he says openly is not true.
That's a statement of faith.
Excuse me?
I agree with you. That's a statement of faith.
You have
to recognize it as such. The very remark you are making necessary is a statement of faith.
What do you
mean
by
faith? That's your faith. I'm not saying that's
Torah Mishnah. As a matter of fact, I didn't get to that point yet.
I'm just saying. Could have been a liar. No. Indeed, he could have been insane at that time with paganism and all that.
Right.
To say these words.
Correct.
Is insanity.
I didn't say he isn't.
Yes.
You get me wrong. I'm not disagreeing with this gentleman. I'm not saying, I appreciate his question, but I'm not saying that he's wrong. I'm just bringing out, if we follow that path, what the result is. I'm not saying that he's wrong. I'm not saying that this isn't the case. I am just saying that if that is so, what the results will be. You see? I'm not maintaining faith that this is so. Follow me? Okay.
One final thing I want to say. You start from faith, though. That's all I was trying to say.
No, I didn't just start from faith. I don't agree with that.
You have faith
in Christianity, too. You have faith in Islam.
You have
faith in
God. Don't you have to believe in the existence of God?
But our question is, existence of God is one thing, but I would question, first of all, I don't have to agree with the existence of God. I could be an atheist. Bertrand Russell was an agnostic. I could believe there are so many different possibilities. The question is, how do I know how to live my life? And believe me, there are many people who will tell you how to live your life, so that there are thousands of ways. You couldn't possibly live every way at one time, so that you have to know what to do. Now, faith isn't enough. Faith might, even if you did have faith in a God, how do you know? But how would you know what God wants you to do? One religion will tell you God wants you to do this.
You're
so we'll get back to that. But how would I know? I'm simply as a humble individual who wishes to know. I would say, go to Rabbi and say, well, tell me, Rabbi, what should I do? Rabbi will take out the sponge over here and say, it's all in here. I go to a priest, he'll tell me, my friend, that has been abandoned a long time ago. That's ancient. What we have is a New Testament. Forget about this. It was a man who was a part of God. I'll have to accept that. I'll go to Islam and they'll tell me about Muhammad. So I'm saying, if I do, and I don't even have to make that beginning. Because I don't have to. People have faith in many things. You know, I met somebody last week who said that they pray to themselves. They have faith in themselves. So that there are many different possibilities of faith. What we are interested in, and she was serious. She wasn't joking. She was serious. She really did. Yes?
Are you saying that what appeared actually what happened?
Well, I didn't say anything yet.
Okay.
All right? See, listen to that one thing. What we are interested in, and she was serious. She wasn't joking. She was serious. She really did. Yes?
Are you saying that what appeared actually what happened?
Well, I didn't say anything yet.
Okay.
All right? See, listen to that one thing. I didn't get to the idea. It's a special. Okay, let me get to the point. All right? I think we'll answer a lot of questions. What I'm going to do now is, if you can just follow along, the next few steps, right, then I think we'll have more of a basis for discussion. Okay, but the next few steps, you really have to follow along, even though it might be a bit complicated, but I don't really think it's that complicated. I would say, going back to what Tom mentioned before, let's speak about the question of, go back to the illustration of, we have a historical documented statement which maintains that George Washington exists. As I said before, we wouldn't question that basic premise. But if we start to see about his shoes, it wasn't documented, the same, well, maybe, conjecture. Okay. Now, I would say as follows, that when a person hears something, automatically to his mind's eye, he sees two possibilities. Possibility A is that what this person is telling me is true. That's one possibility. I think that possibility occurs to everybody. When you hear something, maybe it is true. That's A. There's another possibility that occurs, though. Second possibility is maybe it's false. Right? So that you have here in front of you two possibilities. Okay. Now the basic question is, how do I know which one of these two possibilities is correct? If I had a way of knowing, I wouldn't have any problem. But without a way of knowing, it's a big problem. Okay. I say as follows, that we might as well forget about the possibility of truth, because there's nothing to analyze there. Let's take thoughts. Now, when we listen to somebody tell us something, or we read something, whatever the source might be, so what we do is we say as follows. False. If it's false, we try to find out, well, what would the causes be of this person telling me something that's false? And we try to use our minds. And we say, well, first thing that occurs to us is very well and very much in line with what he wants. You see, he has motivation to lie, correct? That would be one factor. Now, there is one other factor involved. There's only two possibilities on why a person who tells you something is telling you a non-truth. I know it sounds like it's too simple, but I think if you think about it, you'll find out that there are only two possibilities. One possibility is that he has motivation to tell you a lie. The second possibility is maybe somebody wants to guess that one. What was the second possibility?
He doesn't know.
He doesn't know exactly what. He doesn't know. The man does not know. In other words, he's a wonderful person. He wants to tell me the truth. Fine individual, wants to be helpful, but he's unfortunately ignorant. Like I went to a doctor a couple of weeks ago with my daughter, and he gave a prescription that was very dangerous for her. He didn't want to fool me. I don't think the man wanted to harm me. He's a very fine individual, fine doctor. But he didn't have the knowledge in the area. So that a person could tell me something which is false, for one of two possibilities. Either he has a motivation for lying, or else he lacks the knowledge. You see?
Yes. He could be said if he told you something that was true, though.
Excuse me?
The same could be applied to him telling you something that is true.
Did he tell me something that's true because he has the motivation?
Well, he wants you to know the truth, or he thinks it's false and wants to tell you a falsehood when in fact he tells you a truth.
Oh, yes, correct. But in that case, you're not relying on his statement. In other words, if I tell you something that is true, not knowing that it's true, you're not relying on me anymore. Just I happen to say something which coincides with reality.
But if you don't know that it's false and you tell me it's believing that it's true.
No, I'm saying if a person tells you something and he wants you to believe him, right? So in other words, in that case, there are only two possibilities why you should falsify the statement. You follow? If he's telling me the truth, I want to know if he's telling me the truth. If he's telling me the truth, fine, but how do I know he's telling me the truth? There's only one way I can know he's telling me the truth. You see, I can't know directly. So as long as the possibilities of his fabricating a story, his fabrication are there, and the possibility of his ignorance is there, then I have I don't know whether he's telling me the truth. It might accidentally be true, as you say. A person might say, well, we might have said in the year 1500, the atom could be split. But he didn't know that that was so. You see, you might coincide with reality, but I'm not speaking about it. I'm speaking when a person tells me something and expects me to believe him. Now, the first thing that occurs to me is, one second, am I going to make a decision based on what this man is telling me? Well, let me see. If I have to make a decision, I must understand, is he telling me the truth or is he telling me a lie? Well, the truth, I hope so, but I can't tell. The only way I can tell is by removing the possibility of it being a lie. Once I remove the possibility of it being a lie, then I can know that it's the truth because there's no other possibility. In other words, what I'm trying to give you is a formula that the mind works with, you see, that the mind works with in making this important decision in our lives. There is one formula the mind works with. The formula is as follows. When a person tells me something, I say immediately, true or false? False? Just a second. If it is false, there's two possibilities. Either he has a motivation in telling me the falsehood, or else he's ignorant. Now, if I could remove both possibilities, then I would tend to believe that statement. Not only would I tend to believe that statement, I would tend to guide my life and make a decision concerning my life on that statement. That's why if a person is ill, and he goes to the hospital, they say, you must have a very serious operation, and this is the man for the operation. So the person thinks immediately, one second, is there any chance for motivation that you want to kill me? That's ridiculous. Absurd. Ad rule. Does the man have the knowledge? It would seem he's a doctor. He must have the knowledge. So that's why the person makes the decision. You see? So what I am saying is nothing more than showing you the underlying trend, the underlying concepts, the underlying ideas that a person uses in making a decision. And I don't care what field you're in, you use the same process. If you're in business, you use this process. When somebody tells you something, you think, one second. A good businessman knows always to look for the motive, for the ulterior motive. Oh, why is he telling me this part? One second. Let me think about it. If it was, he will accept it more readily from an outsider than from somebody who stands to gain. Because obviously, the person stands to gain, he has motivation. Or he would have kept it from an intelligent man more quickly than from a fool, because the fool might have made a mistake. Correct? So that in our lives, we are guided constantly by this formula. This is the formula which causes us to make most of the decisions in our lives. Okay, at this point, let me hear if there are any questions. I think this is probably half a hundred questions here. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Isn't there a third possibility?
Give me a third possibility.
That the person is deluded, that he is... that he thinks he knows, but he doesn't.
Right. Okay. That's what would you call that?
That would be ignorance.
Right. The causes of ignorance are many. Yes. But we're just taking the general. I would agree that the causes of ignorance are many. In other words, we're going to go into ignorance and list different types of ignorance. But I don't think we have to go any further as far as our investigation right now. I just call it ignorance, so that your case would fall right under that category. Yes?
What I'd say is that I look at it again, especially for say, why does man go about the thought process of deciding whether something is truthful, whether it is helpful or not helpful or not?
Further. When we say that there are two possibilities, a person can be telling you a lie because they have motivation, or he can be telling you a lie because he's ignorant. Now the question is, we rule out these two possibilities and we tend to accept a person. How do we rule out these two possibilities? This is the final thing we have to get to. If we get to this point, how do we rule out these two possibilities? I think then we'll be able to see, perhaps, the divine plan of revelation. Now, the first thing we have to do is understand, how do we rule out the possibility of lying, motivation, fabrication? Paul just mentioned before. He said that if something is documented, many people said it, and I wouldn't... Not the question. In other words, if I walked down the street and somebody came by, or if I was at a subway station and somebody came out of the train, they said, you know, there was a fire on the train. If one person said it, I might question it. But if everybody came off running off the train saying, hey, there's a fire, we might believe it. We'd be more inclined to believe it. Why? Because numbers. You see? Numbers are something that convince us. But why do numbers convince us? For a very good reason, not necessarily a bad reason. We always speak about the bad reasons of accepting numbers, but sometimes it's a good reason. The reason is very simple. The reason is because if we're going to maintain that everybody is telling us a lie, then we have to say that there was a mass conspiracy here. And the concept, the idea of a mass conspiracy, is to our mind pretty far-fetched. In other words, if we read in the history book that George Washington was the first president of the United States, and then we're going to maintain that everything is false. In other words, this isn't his picture. This isn't his writing. This isn't, there is no constitution. There's no other thing. We have to say that the last generation, the whole United States, they all got together and they wanted to fool the next generation. And they said, you know what, we're going to build a whole history and it's going to be false. We might accept that in regard to one or two individuals, 10, 20, 50, but certainly we would not accept it insofar as the whole of mankind is concerned, because we do not believe, we do not maintain that mankind essentially has fallacious intentions. So that the concept of numbers, you see, is very important to us in ascertaining that something is true. If you go to a specialist and he tells you that this is the cause, you go to another one and they verify it. When you see all the lines leading in one direction, you will, if you're a rational person, you will accept it. You have to live that way. Because the chances of a mass conspiracy going on are very remote. Right? And we have to live by that. That's the way we live. You see, that's why if a person tells you, well, go to this hospital, and you say, well, how do you know it's a hospital? They just put the house up 100 years ago, and everybody said they're going to save their doctors. And you go on and on, and they produce documents, and anything can be fabricated. There's no such thing as authentication. Real authentication, there's no way to prove it. You see? If you're going to tell me, well, a scientist can check it in the laboratory, you mean there's certain things you can check, certain things you can't check. And he might be a liar. So there's no end to it. The only thing we have to go by is one concept, and that is that we do not maintain that people have the nature that they will get together just to fool me. And therefore, if everybody maintains that a certain event occurred, we will not say the possibility of mass conspiracy, we do not live with that possibility. If we live with that possibility, I think life would be unbearable. So that this is one possibility we can't live with. Yes?
So what you're saying is the basic premise of logic is that you cannot prove an empirical fact absolutely.
Exactly.
You can't prove that you drop a ball is going to hit the ground every time.
Correct. Correct.
The larger the end, the more significant
the
result.
But we have to live. Right. But the important thing that I would emphasize is that we have to live with that significance. That's how we have to live. Man is unfortunately relegated. He must live according to this. Otherwise, you couldn't go on with your day. You couldn't do a thing. You see? Okay. All right. Yes.
So, the base part of the
objective
is part of the practicality.
Well, practicality, yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's been times in history where great numbers of people
believe. Well, we'll see. Correct. Exactly. We're going to get to that. We're going to get to that. Okay. All right. Now, the first thing that we have to dismiss from our minds in order to know everything is true is whether or not there is mass conspiracy, right? Whether or not there is fabrication. And mass conspiracy, mass numbers remove fabrication. The second question is, knowledge, maybe the person is a fool. So the only way that we could remove that is that we will not accept something from an individual unless it is within his range of reason. In other words, if your neighbor next door would tell you that if you have this illness, take this particular cure, you see, then you would question it. But if a doctor would tell you this, you wouldn't. If a lawyer would tell you, do this, I'm telling you this is what you should tell the judge. Tell him this and you get off. You'll agree with him. But if somebody else tells you, your neighbor say, well, what does he know? Okay. So that in order, the way for a person to know, or how do we treat reality with regard to whether an individual is telling something, whether he knows what he's talking about, is a very simple formula. We only accept things from an individual that are within the range of his knowledge. You see? If you want to know about medicine, you'll ask your medical man. If you want to know about architecture, you'll ask an architect. Want to know about building, you'll ask a builder. You will not ask somebody who doesn't have the knowledge about something which is not his area. So you only accept something which is within the range of the person's knowledge. And therefore, you will remove, this is the way we go about removing the possibility of a person being ignorant. Okay, any questions?
There is as much insecurity in numbers as there is security in numbers. And
in other words,
in numbers, I mean they're mathematical numbers, as in proof or opinion. And I don't totally agree with the fact when you say that when you go to I would not necessarily. Well, as far as medicine,
if your life was at stake, what would you do? Would you accept the man who has the knowledge in medicine, or you accept your neighbor next door?
I would not accept unknowns.
I would go by a
general security of numbers, but still doubt even when I've felt secure.
Right, but you have to make a decision, right? I mean, you can't go around doubting if you have to have an operation. Life's at stake. You say doubting is very nice, but there's a time when you have to make an action. You can't just, it's very nice to sit back and doubt. But unfortunately in life, we have to make decisions. And if we're just going to be doubting philosophers, then we will not be able to exist. I mean, I think that
that's where your intuition comes in.
Well, the question is, what exactly is our intuition? I mean, you wouldn't just intuitively go to anyone at all, you know? I mean, but are you saying, in other words, that you would just go to anyone, like you walk down the street and you saw a garbage collector, you say, well, my intuition tells me he has the answer. Go over there and
No, I didn't say the intuition, think that he has the answer. I'm saying the intuition to take the suggestions and the opinions that you've had.
Right, but wouldn't
and
you
then make an intuitive decision on
Well, the decision might be intuitive, but wouldn't it be based upon certain premises? In other words, you wouldn't just intuitively at random make a decision. You wouldn't go to anybody. So there are certain rules that you're following. Your intuition might come in when you have all the facts set up and you get as close as you can to the truth. But in order to do that, you have to follow certain patterns.
Well, the intuitive process is a process, as you said. It's a gradual understanding, a personal understanding.
Right. Well, you said, for instance, that you go to numbers, and you go to a few doctors, right? Mm-hmm. Is that intuitive?
Eventually, you make an intuitive decision.
I mean, but to go to a few doctors, is that intuitive?
In a way, it is intuitive, because you figure that a medical doctor, if you're looking at
them... questions. If you have a critical mind,
right.
You assess.
That's right.
The answers
exactly.
To those questions.
Right.
Your decision as a critical thinking person is based upon the numbers of... answers that you've gotten to critical questions,
right.
And then
right.
You make your decision.
Right.
Oh,
I'm just showing all
that
you might make the right decision anyway.
Oh, yes,
right,
that's
right.
True.
But you feel
that's
the critical thinker that
that's
you have.
Right.
Yeah.
In some ways, it's by going to more doctors that may.
And if you get the same
answer,
you're
more of a right decision.
I think consistency is another element of what you're speaking about. Another way to find truth is to see whether or not the person is focused. Consistent in what they
do. Absolutely right. And then if he's not, you see he doesn't have the knowledge. That's right. Exactly right. critical mind. Well, that's what she mentioned also. Critical thinking is very important, because if you see they're inconsistent, you see certain things and discrepancies there, then you're liable to...
This is where Jung felt that all of us in religion and religious criticism are having trouble, because we teach kids in school and in college to be critical thinkers.
Right.
And this is what probably is happening this morning. You start to question things, and sometimes you get answers and sometimes you don't.
But well, I would say
we go against the grain of faith and religion to teach our children to be critical thinkers.
I would say that in our religion is suffering from lack of criticism. Because our religion is suffering from the fact that no one really is interested in criticizing it. If people would come to criticize...
Not criticizing, sir.
I don't want to be... I don't mean to criticize certain premises. Would be
critical thinking. Right. Critically acting, not criticizing.
Correct. Well, okay. But the point is, I'm afraid that our religion suffers from the fact that people aren't really interested. On the contrary, there are many answers. But people, unfortunately, for some reason, believe that if they have a question, well, nobody can answer this question. No sense asking that. And therefore, they go on with their lives. Rather than attempting to really go to the people who might have some answers. See, this is unfortunately the case. I would maintain that, on the contrary, that our religion is suffering because people do not seek answers. You know, the psalmist says that God looks down from the heavens and says, I don't see anybody seeking me. Anybody seeking God. To seek God is a wonderful thing, and to be critical is part of our faith, because there is nothing. If you open up the Talmud, you'll find every point is a critical analysis. There is nothing that is accepted just for that. On the contrary, we have never in our history planned upon critical analysis. That's the essence of our faith. Yes?
Aside from just the critical thinking, the primary, secondary, circumstances, there's still a question, the one basic question.
Go ahead.
In any religion, Judaism, if anything, don't you have to have basic tenets of faith?
Let's first get to the answer to this. Then we'll see, okay? Now that's it. Now the question is, as far as we've developed this thought, and I think that if you've kept with us this far, I think you'll be able to appreciate the answer. Because we don't have to go much further than this. I realize this is a bit of a tedious formulation. But insofar as we have gotten so far, we must say that when we analyze something that we hear from the past, from history, from the present, doesn't matter, any secondary knowledge that we have, when we analyze it, you see, then we analyze it on the basis of this formula. So that we say, if it is false, we have to see if it's true or false. Now, how do we know if it's false or not? We have to check out the causes of falsehood. Once we've seen it's not false, it must be true. Falsehood, two possibilities, motivation or ignorance. Okay. Now, I say that when God intended to give the revelation at Sinai, he used the same framework that we are using throughout our lives, that we're understanding today, that we're using at all times to give the Torah at Sinai, so that anyone who will think about Sinai will eventually have to come to the same conclusion, practically speaking, will have to come to the same conclusion that the Torah was given at Sinai and abide by the Torah just as he would if his life were at stake in the hands of a doctor. You see? The same exact decision will have to make. Now I'll show you why. Okay? Let's say you were going to perform an event in history, and you wanted to make sure. One moment, I don't want to be say that we are in place of God, but I'm just saying that for a moment, let us imagine that one of us wanted to perform an event and wanted to make sure that this event should be known not only to this generation, but to the succeeding generations. What would we have to do? Well, let's take an event. Take an event like we mentioned before. George Washington was first president of the United States. Why do we accept it? The reason is very simple. We accept it because it was an event that was done in front of large numbers of people in the entire country. To say that everybody in the country, there was a mass conspiracy to accept that this man was the president when he wasn't, to tell other generations, is an absurdity, right? Okay. Two, is it an event which is hard to obtain knowledge of? Very difficult and complex. No, it's a simple thing. The man was the president. Couldn't be any simpler. Right? It's something which anybody can understand. So that whenever a thing is lost in translation, like when you have a series of telephone conversation, the reason why you have the mistakes in the telephone conversation is because of the complications. If it's a simple thing, I remember the day President Kennedy was shot. I remember when I heard about it, it went through lines of people. And the one at the end of the line got the same message. The president was shot. However, when the question arose, how was he shot, you had about 40 different answers in the head, in the stomach, in the brain, in the eye. No one knows. So later, it sort of clarified. I don't know if to this day if they really clarified it. Some say they did, some say they did. I'm not involved in the area. But The point that he is dead and he was shot, I don't think that has presented much of a problem to the investigators. That everyone is convinced of. Because it is something which was observable and was simple, you see. So that if I wanted to do an event, perform an event, which would be valid and accepted for the succeeding generations, I would have to have one thing in mind. I would have to make sure that the event that occurred was something that everyone could see, was simple in phenomena in its nature. Couldn't be misconstrued. Couldn't be complicated. A simple event. That's one. And two, I would have to make sure that this event took place, not in front of one individual, but in front of many, many people. And that all corroborated to the same exact event. You see? Because if they all corroborate to the same exact event, then I'd be in trouble. You see? Each one would be a personal event. About. Now, that's what I want to say here today. What I want to say here today is this. And as I said before, I do not intend to give a proof, so to speak, of Taramisinai. That I'll leave to your decision. Whether it proves it to you, that you are the one that has to decide. That's a subjective decision. What I want to show you is what the basis of Torah from Sinai is. I want to show you what God's plan was in presenting this, so that there should be a basis for succeeding generations to accept it. So, let us open up the Chumash once again and take a look at the part that we, in Devarim, in Deuteronomy, that part that we're reading. Deuteronomy 4, passage 19. 9, I'm sorry. Okay. Page is 758. I hope you can read through with me several passages, and I believe you'll see immediately what the idea, what the divine plan was, what the idea that Moses was conveying to the Jews was. Namely, that the event at Sinai was an event not just for one generation, but an event for us here today. Let's take a look. He says, only take heed, 9, only take heed to thyself and keep thy soul diligently, lest thou forget the things which thine eyes saw, and lest they depart from thy heart all the days of thy life, but make them known unto thy children and thy children's children. What? The next sentence. The day that thou stoodest before the Lord thy God in Horeb, that's Mount Sinai, where the Lord said unto me, assemble me the people, and I will make them hear my word, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they live upon the earth, and that they may teach their children. Now the important word in that sentence, at first sight, is what?
Assemble
the people. Correct.
What is the meaning of the word in the Hebrew?
Oh, you have to fear me? Okay, we'll go into it. See, there's one thing I want to say about in philosophy of Judaism. There's one thing that you have to be careful about. There are so many areas, Mr. Kaplan is asking you about the question of what does it mean to fear God? To fear God is a concept which I would love to expand upon, but if we do, we're going to lose this. Next time, we'll have to hold it for next time. Okay. Now, the concept was there were many people there. See, it wasn't done for one person. The revelation at Sinai was done in front of all the people, an assemblage of all the people. That's one. Why was it necessary to have an assemblage of all the people? Why couldn't God just speak to Moses? What's the reason why? Witnesses. Who said this happened? How do you know that Columbus discovered America? How do you know? Who knows? How do you know anything in history? If it was done privately, we're not going to accept that as history. History had to be done in front of masses of people. So when God realized that this must be a proof of succeeding generations, he knew it had to be done in front of everybody. Otherwise, it couldn't be accepted. And the only basis that we have to accept any historical fact is the same concept that was done in front of the entire mass of people. Otherwise, you'd say, well, one person, he has motivation. When Mohammed claims that God revealed himself to him at Mecca in the cave, you see, that is a very nice claim. But was there anyone else there to see this? No. So how could we don't have to accept such a thing. But if Mohammed would claim that God revealed himself in front of the entire nation and the world, whole world saw that this occurred, that would be a different story. But I don't think he'd make such a claim, you see. Now the point is that when God gave the Torah, he realized that the only possible way that people will not be able to say that this is just conjecture is that it's done openly in front of everybody. And that's why the truth of the matter is, when other religions say that there are other revelations, there is only one revelation, there's only one mass revelation. Other religions have private revelations, not mass revelations. Let's take a look a little further. So like this. Stood under the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire unto the heart of heaven with darkness, cloud, and thick darkness. Now it burned unto the heaven with darkness, cloud, and thick darkness. Something which any person could see. A person can see whether the sun is shining or it's not shining. Whether it's cloudy or when there's a fire. A person doesn't have to be a brilliant physicist to know this. So then anyone that sees this can observe it and can verify it. It was phenomena that were simple phenomena. Why did they have to be simple phenomena? Because of the second concept that we mentioned. In order to know whether a person is telling the truth, you have to know whether it's within his range of knowledge. Now, therefore, the events at Sinai had to be simple events. Events that anyone could tell over. Something anyone could know. If somebody comes and tells me it's raining outside, I'll say, 1 second, what's your IQ? I don't have to ask them. A simple thing. So the events at Sinai were simple. The mountain burned with fire unto the heart of the heaven, that means high up, with darkness, cloud, and thick darkness. And the Lord spoke unto you out of the midst of the fire. Ye heard the voice of words, but ye saw no form, only a voice. So the phenomena was such that there was no visible physical thing, physical object, but the voice, a certain voice which was produced by God, from the mountain, was produced by God, which was audible to every single person that stood at that site. And he declared unto you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, even the 10 words, the 10 commandments. And he wrote them upon 2 tablets of stone. And the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and ordinances. Okay, fine. Now, let's take a look again. Moses reiterates this a little bit further. He says as follows. And it's page 32. For if now of the days past, which were before thee, since the day that God created man upon the earth, and from the one end of the heaven unto the other. In other words, ask at any point in history, ask from all the events of the past. Now take a look at what he says. Whether there has been any such thing as this great thing, or has there been heard anything like it? Did ever a people hear the voice of God speaking out of the midst of the fire as thou hast heard and live? You see, what is Moses telling them over here? Moses is telling them a very simple thing, that there is no religion in the world. There is never, if you take a look throughout history, and the interpretations say that this was written so that any time you read the Chumash, you'll always be able to say, take a look at history. Did you ever have an occurrence where a whole nation of people heard the voice of God, saw a revelation, and understood the revelation, and all were able to state over exactly what happened? Never. That's what he says. Did ever a people hear the voice of God speaking out of the midst of the fire as thou hast heard him live? You see? Or has God essayed to go and take him a nation from the midst of other nations by trials, by signs, and by wonders, and by war, and by a mighty hand, and by an outstretched arm, and by great terrors, according to all that the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? So the important thing is that what? What is the concept that Moses is telling the people? He's telling them that God has done this in a way that you will know forever, for all time, just like you know any other historical fact, and just like you accept any type of secondary knowledge in your life. And everyone in your life must accept secondary knowledge. We've shown it, otherwise you couldn't live. You can be a philosopher and say, well, I don't know if this exists. And you can go to college, you can discuss whether we exist or not. But practically speaking, there is a certain way that you have to follow in your life. And God arranged Sinai, the revelation at Sinai, that it should be exactly in the same way as you act in all your practical affairs. So that just like it is practical for a person to go to a physician if he is ill, it is practical for a person to abide by the Ten Commandments. Because it is based upon the exact same premises. It was an event that was done in front of an entire nation, so that the numbers are there. Mass conspiracy for one thing is irrational, is absurd, just like we wouldn't accept it in any other area. We wouldn't accept it over here, because there are people that are honest and they wouldn't stand for it. For the same reason, the events that were done were simple events. The fire, the darkness, the sound, the voice, which the powerful voice which the people heard, which they knew could not be produced by any individual, but they realized that this is a voice from a strange, from a different source, you see. This all showed one thing. It showed Sinai. It showed that this revelation is a revelation which will exist, which has existed in the past, and which will always exist. Because it contains in itself the formula which we use in order to live our everyday existence. And that's why it's just as real as any other practical part of our lives. So that, in other words, the question is not a philosophical one, it's a practical one. If you want to be practical, then you have to accept the revelation at Sinai. If you don't want to be practical, then, of course, you don't have to accept that. No, you have to accept any other practicality. Yes.
I still get back to the question, just for a moment, you still have to go back on faith, and this is interpretation still in favor. Well, because by what you've just said, we all have to become Christians, because the Christians repeated this. They had Jesus with them, and they'd be blind.
Your question is Christianity. Okay. You realize I can't go through every single religion right now, but I certainly will take Christianity and Islam. I think Islam we've mentioned already. They have faith. Well, let's analyze it quickly. And I don't mean to be derogatory to any other religion. That is not my purpose here. My purpose here today is rather to understand clearly what the concepts of Judaism are. And I don't mean to degrade any other faith, but it is only in order to understand what we believe in and what we are trying to seek the truth. So therefore, we have to be able to take other religions as well. Yes? You want to, should I say that?
Other corroborative sources for witnesses of this mass event.
Well, I'll tell you, the point of this is that if you want other corroborative sources, there are other corroborative sources, the Holocaust agreement, so I'm not going to do that. The point that I want to mention is this, that the corroborative sources are the masses themselves. In other words, you don't have to have corroborative sources for corroborative sources. If you have an event... The one source is thousands of people. If you have one source, let's say, for instance, you went to 15 doctors and they all told you one thing. You say, now, what source is that for them?
No.
The source is, they are the source.
No, I have one source. The source
it's not
is...
source.
I see.
In other words, you mean like this. What you're asking is that maybe, let me try to put the question this way. You're asking maybe one person made up the all these things. Is that what you're saying? In other words, your question is, there weren't thousands of people. Maybe there's one person that said there were thousands of people and it's all one source. Is that your question?
The question that you're quoting from, the source that we're reading from, is a single source, the
Torah. Right, the Torah. So your question is maybe there's one person that fabricated the source, right? Is that your question?
Not necessarily, other alternative sources other than Torah that describe the same...
Well, what alternative sources do you have other than the Constitution for the Constitution?
Yeah,
what do you have to have alternative sources for? What alternative sources do you have for... What alternative sources do you have for, let's say, for instance, if you study history of China, Chinese historians, you wouldn't trust them. Even if I give you a source for that, what source will you have for the whole world sources?
For any particular event,
yeah.
In Chinese history,
yeah.
If I want corroborative sources,
yeah.
I can go to any one of a number of scholars who have separate documents.
And what corroborative sources do you have for that?
Well, that's sufficient corroboration. We're talking from a single document.
Well, let me ask you this. In any event that occurs, in other words, let's say, for instance, if a house burns down, right? And you wouldn't accept this as so if you saw 1,500 people settle as so. Because you wouldn't have corroborative sources from China or from England. You say that?
No, why would I have 1,500 people?
Right. Oh, well, that's what you have here. The question, if you ask me, are there other corroborative sources, my question to you is, does every event that you accept in your life have many other corroborative sources?
Yes.
It does. In other words, if the house burned down the corner, you wouldn't accept this as an event unless you corroborated from let's say you didn't see it.
Well, then I would speak to five different people who did see it.
Oh, right. But those five different people then would be your sources, correct?
Yes.
Okay, well, let's say you had a whole nation of people. Would that be enough for you? You don't have anything in front of you. What do you have in front of you? What do you have in front of you? In other words, every history is limited to its time and place. If you have Columbus discovering America, it's limited to Spain and to America.
I have the diaries of five of the sailors who were on the
ship. But that's not corroboration. Those are the people who are there. You want corroboration from another source.
No.
Where do you have the source?
They're definitely...
each one of those is a different source.
Oh, well, over here you have a different primary source, because everyone in the nation tells you that they accept...
I've got a single primary source.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. What would you accept more readily? If you had one document and everybody swears to that document, or if everybody writes up his own document, what should you accept more readily?
Each one writing up his document.
Why? What's the difference does it make if each one... I'll tell you, so if that's the case, so every Sefer Torah is another document. Now you have hundreds of Sefer Torah that each one says that this is the correct account. What difference does it make? So what else? Everyone here, right in this room, and we all signed the document testifying to that event. Wouldn't that be corroborative sources?
We had each signature.
Right. Okay. Well, what more of a signature? What more of a signature do you require than the fact that everyone in the nation accepts that particular statement, those particular statements? Isn't that the greatest signature of all? If people live according to those documentations and everybody accepts it, wouldn't it be the greatest?
Where the case
they live according to them.
And that they accept it is true.
Well, the thing is, we only know that Moses said they accepted it.
Gentlemen
deluded.
Oh, okay. Oh,
that's the point.
No, okay.
I agree with what you say, and the fact that
right.
we are
doing
one that is fine, but logically and consistently, he's right.
Well, let me just bring that in. If that's the question, I want to see where the question is. If that's the question, then I'll tell you the answer to that question. Okay. The answer to that question is as follows. It is a known fact historically that in the time of Ezra, if you go back to the time of King David, there is no doubt that at the time of King David, that the Jews accepted the revelation at Sinai. There's no doubt about that, that the nation accepted it. There is no doubt that the nation accepted Sinai at the time of Ezra. Now, do you realize, if you take a look at it, let's take a look at the possibilities. There are two possibilities there. One is that the event actually occurred. Two, if the event didn't occur, it would mean that somebody would have to come along and fabricate such an event. Now, could you imagine if a person came along and started to fabricate for us an event that took place? Let's say somebody said to us that God revealed himself 200 years ago in front of the entire United States. Correct? Would we accept such an event? We certainly would. What? No, one second.
Yes.
Would we accept such? Why wouldn't we accept such an event? No, not an open...
Not
an open,
but the Mormon... No,
we would not accept... No, not as an open public... I'm talking about an open public event. I'm not talking about a private... I'm talking about an open public event that God committed. God did an impurity event. An act which was public knowledge. I mean, like an act which everyone could see with their own eyes. You see? That we wouldn't accept. You know why we wouldn't accept it? Because we'd say, if that was the case, then how come we didn't hear about that? You can't come along at a later point in history and maintain that an event occurred which didn't occur in front of everybody. You can fabricate a private thing, but you can't fabricate a public thing. So that if it really didn't occur, then that means that, let's say, King David lived 300 years after the revelation, right? Now, if everybody accepted at that time, and it was accepted because of a lie, someone who lied, one source, as you asked, one source, then that would mean that this one source had to fabricate an event that happened in front of the entire nation. Who would believe him? It would be an absurdity. And if you think that people then were any more gullible than they are today, then you're making a mistake. That's not true. Because people, anyone that studies ancient cultures knows that an Egyptian wasn't an idiot, he wasn't a fool, he was an intelligent person. Just like we are today.
We fabricated public events.
Show me one.
American history for years. Our history.
Give me a fabricated public event. I'd like to know.
Okay. Yeah. The fabrication that the Indians were the first people to scalp white people.
Right.
Okay, that's a fabrication.
Right.
And that's something that only in the last, I believe, 10 years.
Well,
the truth of that has been documented.
Now, who was the first to scalp white people?
The English.
Okay.
The English were the first to scalp Indians. And they did it for a bounty.
Well, you understand, obviously, the reason why that can be done. You see why that can be done? Because exactly the way I've been explaining to you all, that a person scalping an individual, who is the first to scalp an individual, is not a public event done in front of the entire nation. It's something which is done privately in the bush, so that we can maintain that this Indian is the first one to do this. There's no one to contradict it. You can fabricate an event which was a private occurrence, but you cannot fabricate an event that was a public occurrence. That is impossible. Ah, good question. I was waiting for that question. Right, very good.
And a lot of people believe him.
Right, good. Now, I'd like to show you precisely from Hitler why it can't be done. I'll show you exactly why. You see, when we say that you cannot fabricate a public event, what I mean is not a public belief, but a public event.
And there is a tremendous difference between a public event and a public belief. You see, Hitler maintained that he was chosen by God to carry out his evil mission. But I will say this, that if Hitler could maintain that there was an event that took place in front of the entire German nation, a miraculous event, to demonstrate that he's appointed by God, you can be sure he would maintain that. I don't think he'd doubt if he could get away with it. But even he would never maintain such a thing, because he knows that people knew that it was untrue, it never happened. What he could maintain is the belief that he is ordained by God. Because you could fool people when it comes to belief, but you cannot fool people when it comes to their senses. You cannot tell them that you saw God appointing me in front of the entire generation. That's impossible. Because if that was the case, they'd say, when? Where did it occur? We never saw such a thing. Sinai maintains public events, physical phenomena. Is that a belief anybody can maintain can fool people with belief? Public belief certainly is capable of being fooled in terms of what to believe, but not in terms of what occurred to their physical senses. And that was why, when God gave the Torah at Sinai, he didn't leave it to belief. He left it to a physical occurrence that was open for everyone to examine and to see for themselves. Now, this cannot be fabricated, because anyone that comes along later and maintains that this event occurred when it didn't, they'd say, one second, how come we never heard about that? You mean to say, 100 years ago, God revealed himself in the middle of New York City in front of everybody and performed miracles? We never read anything about that in the New York Times. How come we hear about it? So that a public event you cannot fabricate. But you can fabricate a public event, you can't fabricate a public belief. That's for sure. Yes? Concepts that are used in magic, just out of curiosity. If anyone that has studied any of those areas would know that certainly certain things can be done which would appear to be quite odd because of a method of sleight of hand, as I mentioned here. But I think that you will agree simultaneously that that method has certain inherent limitations. You see? You could not produce a jet plane with sleight of hand. You could not produce a television with sleight of hand. There's certain things, there's certain limitations which an individual has.
Not so sure.
Within the, you're not sure with that? Well,
I saw a tiger disappear.
I'm serious. I know. Now, the answer is as follows. I want you to understand one thing about the Christianity. And this is something which I think, I don't think anybody knows the history of Christianity with doubt. The Christianity is a religion which is based upon the belief in a certain individual by the name of Yeshua, Jesus. And the truth of the matter is that the miracles that were claimed that he had performed were claimed, interestingly enough, not in front of the nation where he claimed to perform them, but somewhere else completely. As a matter of fact, the documentation of the New Testament didn't begin until 30 or 50 years after he died and continued over a period of hundreds of years. The people that they were speaking to convince them that Jesus actually did these things were not in the same land or from the same offspring or have the same historical records as the people where they claimed it was done. In other words, if I come to you today from Africa and I say, you know, I saw unbelievable events that occurred, public events occurred in Africa, you see, you would have a hard time confuting what I said. You'd have a hard time questioning or refuting what I said. You might say, well, I don't believe it. But you would certainly have a hard time refuting me. You see, if I would tell you that I've just seen something that occurred here in front of everybody, you'd say, one second, I didn't hear anything about that. I live here too, you know. And you're telling me this, how come I didn't hear about it? So the point is as follows. With Christianity, the odd thing is as follows. All the miracles that were claimed
by the Christians were claimed to other nations. Rome was claimed to succeed with the different nations, but it was not, as a matter of fact, the Jews were in the place where Jesus supposedly performed his miracles did not even accept him. So that the biggest question to Christianity was always, how could you possibly, if you tell me that these events occurred in front of the entire nation, why is it that the nation where it occurred, those people do not accept it? You see? You can tell others that a great miracle has occurred over there, but you can't tell the people who have...